Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description. All right. You know, I got to say, it feels good to sit down and kind of do this the normal way. Do my research, you know, get caught up on what's going on and then share it with you. I really enjoyed the last couple of weeks, but it's good to get back to normal. This time of year is fun because we start to see all sorts of articles coming out talking about 2025. What happened in 2025? You know, a lot of them are very specific about records broken or trends that were noticed. And then we also start to see lots of articles that talk about 2026 and what to expect or what we should try and accomplish and what to look out for. So I'm going to take some time. I've got several articles here that look back on 2025. I'm probably going to briefly speak on some of them, might go into a little bit more depth on others, and maybe even just read the headlines of a few as well. We may dig deeper into some of these in the coming days. So the first one I want to take a look at here is from The Guardian, and it is called, Was 2025 the Year That Business Retreated from Net Zero? From retailers to banks, these are being watered down or scrapped. So basically, this article takes different categories and talks about the various reactions this year from those industries when it comes to their commitments to hit net zero. It opens by saying, almost a year since Donald Trump returned to the White House with a rallying cry to the fossil fuel industry to drill, baby, drill, a backlash against net zero appears to be gathering momentum. More companies have retreated from or watered down their pledges to cut carbon emissions, instead prioritizing shareholder returns over climate action. It talks about how earlier this year, the Conservative Party leader in the UK, Kemi Badenoch, sorry if I'm saying that wrong, maybe I should know who this is, but I don't, officially ditched net zero by 2050 as a Tory policy. Labour was even forced to defend its net zero policy after an attack by its former leader, Tony Blair. So looking into a few of these categories, it talked short-lived successful time during COVID in which emissions went down, production was down, etc., etc. However, Trump has torn up U.S. electric vehicle subsidies, costing carmakers billions, and eased emissions rules to allow them to sell more cars with polluting petrol and diesel engines. This week, Ford said it would take a $19.5 billion write-down and is scrapping several EV models. Just as a side note, I know that one of their most popular models, the Lightning, they are discontinuing. It is currently one of, really, the only truck options out there, especially affordable truck options. There are others like the Rivian, but you got to spend $80,000 if you want to go with a Rivian. There are, you know, a couple that are very lightweight options, but this does not spell good things for the future of the electric market, especially in its capability of branching outside of just compact cars. The EU this week said that 10% of car makers' sales could be petrol or diesel even after 2035 in a significant climb down, and the UK government said in April it would ease its zero emission mandate. The rules still force car makers to sell more electric cars each year, but new loopholes mean they can sell more hybrids, which combine a smaller battery with an internal combustion engine. Airbus delayed their plans to fly a plane using zero-emission green hydrogen by 2035. And then it says, neither did the UK government policy on aviation inspire confidence that net zero remained front and center. On the energy front, it talks about how in the UK, green energy investors remain buoyed up by the Labour's aims to the net target for now. However, the government's green targets were dealt a blow earlier this year when the struggling Danish renewable energy company Ørsted cancelled plans for one of the UK's largest offshore wind farms off the Yorkshire coast. Europe's oil majors, including BP and Shell, have retreated from their climate commitments in favor of refocusing on oil and gas production. In banks and financial services, the most public sign of the U-turn has been the collapse of the Net Zero Banking Alliance, NZBA, in October, after a wave of departures by U.S. banks, including J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs, as well as U.K. lenders Barclays and HSBC. The UN-backed program, which was launched in 2021, had committed firms to achieving net zero by 2050, had months earlier announced it was delaying important parts of its climate goals by 20 years. Vanguard and BlackRock have also pulled membership from a sister group known as the Net Zero Asset Managers, and there are fears The Labour Party could water down plans to require FTSE 100 firms and financial services to adopt credible climate transition plans. In retail, Morrisons, the supermarket chain, delayed its ambition for net zero by 15 years. The British Retail Consortium industry body set out a roadmap to net zero by 2040, and only 38% of top suppliers have committed to meeting net zero. Obviously, as you can tell here, being a Guardian article, most of this is talking specifically about UK companies, but this is happening, you know, widely in the West, and probably even worse currently in the US. The article ends by talking about local authorities and how many local authorities in the UK and municipalities are decreasing their commitments. Some areas, it says here, in reform-led Lincolnshire, Mayor Andrea Jenkins has vowed to block any renewables projects in her jurisdiction, while Staffordshire County Council, also reform-controlled, has rescinded its declaration of a climate emergency. Durham Council has scrapped its heat pump and solar panel scheme for government buildings. Derbyshire County Council disbanded its Climate Change, Biodiversity and Carbon Reduction Committee. And West Northamptonshire County Council abandoned its net zero target. All right, so this is just a summary of many of the ways in which businesses are sort of giving up on net zero. And frankly, this year, I feel like we heard almost nothing about it. This is, again, here locally in large part due to Donald Trump, but these commitments that had previously been made are gone or are leaving. And it sucks because this often happens with the change of presidents, right? So businesses, when Obama won, took on this sort of what the right would call woke cultural ideas, the DEI and those types of things. And then Trump became president first in 2016, and that stuff went away. Many companies went away from talking about that and took on more of a conservative approach to things. And then in 2020, Biden won, and they brought that stuff back. And then Trump won, and now it's gone again. Corporations want support and money, and they follow whoever is in power. And right now, Donald Trump, you know, in the U.S., we're talking specifically, is talking down on, calling it a hoax, right? Climate change, net zero, all of these different things, the Paris Climate Accord. And many companies and corporations are following that. They no longer have to be held to this image of even attempting to prevent climate change. And so many of them do not. It goes to show that much of those commitments were likely just performative anyway. I don't know that there was any real doubt about that. And that most corporations will simply do whatever it is they can do to make the most amount of profit possible. In the UK, it's especially interesting because so much of this was legislative, right? It was required. It was regulated. But even that is starting to disappear. Okay, moving on from there, I want to just mention another article. We're not going to go deep into this one, which states that record fossil fuel emissions in 2025, despite renewables build out, according to a report. And basically the point of this is saying that the global carbon budget estimates a 1.1% increase in CO2 emissions in 2025 over 2024. We are continuing to increase our emissions year over year. Not only are we not hitting net zero, we're actually growing in the amount of emissions that we are releasing into the atmosphere. One standout is a 6.8% rise in emissions from aviation as that industry continues to boom. Now, what's interesting is to take into account the idea that renewables have grown massively. Wind is up 7 to 8%. Solar generation is over 30% growth just this year. And so with these renewables growing as much as they are, the claim originally was we're going to replace fossil fuel emissions with renewables. We're not even meeting the demand of the growth. It feels like we should by now be able to at least say that the amount that we're emitting is decreasing, but it's not. We're not there yet. A part of that is that, you know, electrical energy is really only, what was it, a third of all of the energy consumption. There are so many other ways in which we are consuming and emitting fossil fuels. And so it just brings about this question, are renewables simply supplementing? It's the Jevons paradox at play, right? As we have more capacity to spend more energy or to consume more energy, are we simply doing it? Are we not replacing what was being spent? We're just adding to it. And renewables are not free. They don't come at zero expense, right? And I'm not talking about financial expense. I'm talking about resource usage, pollution creation, those types of things. Net zero is a fantasy, in my opinion. Might they find a way to make it appear on paper that we have hit net zero? Sure. Is it coming when they said they were going to? No. They're already behind. It may be a decade away still. And even when they do, can we actually say we've netted out at zero? Again, I think they can make it appear that way and they can claim it. But when it comes to the effects of the in the environment to the climate, are we actually at, you know, an effective net zero harm? Unlikely. All right. Moving on from that, we've now basically just established that people are giving up on net zero, that we are not decreasing, but actually continuing to increase the amount of fossil fuels being emitted each year. Now we can read this article in resilience.org. So this is another one out of the UK. This is by Rupert Redd, who was founder of the Extinction Rebellion movement. And I just want to take a second and highlight here the fact that the US is 5 to 6 times the population of the UK. And yet we have like next to nothing when it comes to media and movements and people and organizations who are fighting against climate change. I shouldn't say next to nothing. I know they exist, but it's just interesting that all of the stuff that we hear about and we see and we read is coming out of the UK. And hopefully organizations in the US can pick it up and get more exposure. So the title of this is "The End of 2025 Must Be the End of the Inane Rule of Climate Optimism." We were supposed to have gone net zero by now. That was Extinction Rebellion's central demand when we formed it 7 years ago. Can we all please at last acknowledge and take seriously the utter failure to do so? Only such acknowledgement will prevent us from continuing collectively to basically ignore the increasingly pressing need to actually focus resources on a strategy beginning with climate adaptation. We should admit that widely mandated climate optimism has been actively harmful to the needful acknowledgement of reality and to the active collective self-protection that we now desperately need to get serious about making happen. I'm not going to read through this whole article. It's lengthy. I will, like always, post it so that you can read it in the description. But he essentially starts off by talking about how, hey, look, climate optimism had its chance. We've been talking about the climate for decades. We've made our goals, we've had our targets, and it hasn't worked. Climate optimism has won out as far as being the leading form of communication in the media, from our leaders, et cetera, et cetera. Being real about the climate has been looked down upon. Being at all negative about potential impacts, being blunt, has not been well received. That's had its time. It did not work. And now we're at a point where we need to come to terms with the facts and the way that things are. He has a section called "Why Adaptation Has to Move Center Stage." A powerful way to enable this goal is by focusing far more seriously on adaptation, on preparing for the impacts that are already unfolding. When people can see tangible steps they can take to protect their homes, neighborhoods, and families, engagement is more likely to shift into gear. And I think this is a great point. By having this immense amount of climate optimism and continuously saying, we can still stop this, we can still change things, that is signaling to people, it's telling them, you don't need to prepare for negative impacts because we can still stop those negative impacts from happening. No, we cannot. We can stop them from getting worse and worse and worse, right? We can make them better than they could be. But that's not the message that's getting out. The message is, let's stay below 1.5 so that nothing changes. But either way, the message is not, we need to prepare for the things that have already become baked in, right? He says, climate realists and pragmatists need to retain and in fact upgrade our ambitiousness, but we need to stop pretending that full decarbonization is achievable within rational timetables and switch to calling for the enacting now of protective, deep, strategic, and transformative adaptation to our terrifying emerging terra incognita. He says this will also have the huge advantage of potentially making us popular again by way of starting where people are with climflation, i.e. climate-driven cost of living increases, with a rising tide of disasters and rising insurance premiums. How does this start in practice? At a local level, communities can take part in retrofit programs that make buildings safer in heat waves and storms, as well as reducing energy bills. Households and neighbors can work together to reduce flood risk by choosing planting over paving or using permeable materials where hard surfaces are unavoidable. Community food growing schemes, rewilded churchyards, and shaded green spaces help cool neighborhoods while supporting wildlife. So he goes on to give some other examples with water and general preparedness. At the end, he talks about how it is essential that we do not double down on optimism. And he puts optimism in quotes here. And I think it's important too, because there's optimism the way that people view it normally, and there's true optimism, which is doing the best that you can in the situation that you're in and working towards the best outcome. He says, "But I know what some will say in response to this litany of inconvenient truths. They will say that even now, halfway through the dismal failing of the critical decade, we must focus on being climate optimists. This narrative ignores the very real downsides of misplaced optimism. Consider, for instance, the Polish officer class executed by the Soviets at Katyn. The very few who survived were those who were most pessimistic about their chances when they were arrested, because they, and they alone, were sufficiently desperate to try to run away. This example in the present context might seem overdramatic, but note this. Being overdramatic is exactly what some of those who fled before Katyn were accused of being. Moreover, within the lifetimes of most resilience readers, the climate crisis will likely take many more lives than the Second World War did. It has already taken several million lives, not to mention those who die from air pollution. If we are to survive what is coming, let alone to manage to flourish through it, then we desperately need the kinds of strategic climate adaptation indicated and outlined above, which false optimism leaves unfunded or even sneered at. We need to actually prepare in holistic ways that can work for the unparalleled storm of our children, for multi-breadbasket failure, for temperatures that can kill, and for much more unpredictable effects." Now, at the end, I like this last paragraph. He says, "Recognizing the extent to which we have failed so far and the extent to which the mitigation decarbonization story is stalled is a necessary prelude to starting anew. A new phase is upon us. New thinking and new acting could make all the difference. Post-optimism, pre-any doom. Such exciting, essential change might even make it truly possible to envisage a happy new year." And look, there at the end is the actual type of optimism that we need. Not the optimism that says everything's going to be fine, someone's going to fix this, all we need to do is think happy thoughts and, you know, corporations will take care of the rest. It's the optimism of saying, what is actually in our control to do? What actions can we take to best protect ourselves, to best protect the ones we love, and to best protect our neighborhoods and communities? There is still change that we can make that can help. As an individual, by storing 50 gallons of water in my garage, I have done something to help myself. By putting away a little bit of food storage, I have done something to help myself. By getting myself out of debt the best I can, or by learning to garden, little by little, I can do things to help protect myself. Now, what he's talking about here in the article takes it a step up, or maybe two or three steps up, and says, what can we do to help our communities? What can we do to help push our local authorities towards making decisions that protect our local environment, that help adapt and prepare for the future that is coming? But it does not help to ignore the impacts of what is already going to come because of where we have put ourselves today. We have already done a certain amount of harm, and we have to live with that. We have to recognize that as a system, as a whole, we are not moving towards 1.5 degrees Celsius. We're not moving towards 2. We're moving to blow past that. And the climate optimism of saying we can turn it around, all it takes is corporations to do their part, that's not working. It hasn't worked, and it's not going to work. The truth is that many locales, many cities, many municipalities, many governments are not going to do anything to adapt, but some will. And the ones that take action the most, that invest the most, that take the time and energy and resources to A, adapt, and B, mitigate, will be better off as a whole. The future we're going into is going to involve a whole lot of luck, a whole lot of timing, and some preparation as well. And like Rupert says here, those organizations, those locales who are willing to accept the inconvenient truths and make changes today, if combined with some luck, those are going to be the areas, those are going to be the people who are going to fare the best. What does that mean for each of us? Well, I don't know. What is in your control? Is it in your control where you live? Is it in your control to live in an area where these things are being taken more seriously, where luck and circumstance might be better on your side? You know, are you doing the best you can the things for yourself and for your family, to accept these inconvenient truths, to prepare, to mitigate. And I guess lastly, and this is something I've been reflecting on more lately, is what is ours to do? What is mine to do to help? Maybe it is something personal. Maybe it is something within the family. Maybe it is something within the community, or maybe it is something bigger. But for those of us who have already accepted and understood these inconvenient truths, what is ours to do? What is within our control? And let's get working on those things. That's optimism. All right. Thanks for being here. See you tomorrow.
Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.